This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 20 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we'll be discussing Star Trek Into Darkness and the ethical issue of preemptive war. Zachary, I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, likewise. It's been a busy day at work, but I'm looking forward to talking about Star Trek Into Darkness. You know, last week on Metatrex, we mentioned Star Trek Into Darkness, and I kind of mentioned that Star Trek Into Darkness gets a bad rap from the fans. While it's not one of my favorite Star Trek movies, in fact, it might even be last on the list, if you can believe that, I think there are some really interesting philosophical threads that kind of get overshadowed because the movie fails in a lot of other ways. So I'm looking forward to diving in and just picking up some of those threads and seeing if we can paint Star Trek Into Darkness in a slightly better light than it's gotten in a lot of fan feedback.
Yeah, we were talking in the turbo lift on the way here, and this definitely is kind of at the bottom of my list. I was very hopeful when Star Trek 2009 came out, and the whole thing blowing up Vulcan, and you know, I left there a little bewildered, but eventually I accepted it. And by the time we got to Star Trek Into Darkness, I was very hopeful, and it was just salt in the wound. But it did raise some very interesting ethical dilemmas, I think. Some good discussion I think we're going to have here regarding preemptive war. And I think it might be interesting, too, to kind of compare the attitudes towards the Klingons, in particular, from the original timeline to the JJ verse, and just kind of draw some comparisons and talk about the difference in the attitude of the Federation, and you know, how all of that played into the, you know, how it was handled in the Prime Universe as opposed to how it was handled in Star Trek Into Darkness.
You know, it's no secret to Star Trek fans that Star Trek has always made an effort to be socially and politically relevant. And I think, you know, in the last 15 years in this country, it's been a turbulent times. We had September 11th. We had the war in Iraq. You know, countless other events that we could talk about in the world. And, you know, as I see it, I can see what the writers were going for in Star Trek Into Darkness. You know, the issue of how far we as a society should be willing to go to protect ourselves. Should we go as far as creating new kinds of weapons? Should we go as far as starting preemptive wars? So on and so forth. And I think that Star Trek Into Darkness was really trying to latch onto those issues, but it got a bit distracted by everything else that the writers were trying to do inside that movie, you know, trying to get Khan into the picture and trying to, you know, in a way try to tell a story that's parallel to what you see in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, but kind of failing at every level, I think. There's some scenes that I really like. I think maybe halfway into the movie, I think I was still really engaged. And then when the movie really started to parallel Star Trek II in this reverse, you know, we've got Spock screaming Khan, and we've got Kirk dying instead of Spock, and it really lost me at a certain point. They were trying to do way too much, almost be too clever with the parallels with Star Trek II. But I guess my point is just that the issues of preemptive war and the issues of how far we as a society should go to protect ourselves really get overshadowed by all the weaknesses of the movie, and I think that's a bit of a shame because the writers really had a good idea there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the idea was really interesting. The execution was rather poor. You talked about the parallels and the reversals. You know, it was Spock screaming Khan, and it was Kirk who sacrificed himself to save the Enterprise. I think the only thing we were missing were possibly a few goatees.
You know, it actually reminds me of a great many Star Trek The Next Generation episodes where there's a really fascinating A plot, but oftentimes there's a really disappointing and uninspired B plot. You know, that really distracts from the A plot. And that seems to be what's going on in Star Trek Into Darkness. The A plot is actually really interesting. This issue of, potentially starting a war with the Klingons, building new kinds of weapons. Of course, you know, it gets a little ridiculous when you get out and when Admiral Marcus goes out and tries to, when you realize that John Harriman is Khan, and it starts to, you know, get a little muddy and not make sense anymore. So as I see it, I think the writers of Star Trek Into Darkness were really just trying to do too much. You know, like I said, it reminds me of a Star Trek The Next Generation episode where there's a really interesting A plot, a relatively uninspired B plot, and the B plot totally distracts from the screen time on the A plot. I really could have spent more time diving into the ethical issues of whether we should be starting preemptive wars. You know, what should we be developing new kinds of weapons? And if you look back at the history of the 20th century, we can see the development of new kinds of weapons for the sake of winning wars. You know, we had the atomic bomb, we had the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. It's not a preemptive war, but it's a preemptive strike. It's a proactive way of fighting a war with a goal of trying to prevent further suffering or prolonging the war. And in that sense, it really has shades of consequentialist ethics, where the goal is to maximize overall good consequences. And if that means saving lives by preventing a war by means of going out and actively, you know, causing violence in the sense of using new weapons and starting preemptive wars, then that's okay according to consequentialism, because that would maximize overall consequences. That's viewed as being better than letting the war, you know, go on longer and having more people die as a result of a prolonged war. So, you know, I think that's a fascinating issue. And of course, just sadly, in Star Trek Into Darkness, because of the relatively tedious B plot with Khan, you know, that kind of deep dive into the ethical issue of preemptive war and different sort of ethical takes and whether that's acceptable or not really kind of gets glossed over in light of the action of Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, and I want to go on record as saying I actually like J.J. Abrams' Khan. I really like the character in his movie. I like the way Benedict Cumberbatch portrays him as very, very thoughtful, very intelligent, but very capable.
I've got to agree with you on that. I think Benedict Cumberbatch did a really good job capturing the intensity of Khan. Mm-hmm. The thing I don't like, I think with Ricardo Montalban in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, you got kind of a quiet intensity. It was intense, but it was underspoken.
Yeah.
Very seldom got loud, and you could just sort of see the intensity even without any action. You can see it in his eyes. And I think, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch did a pretty good job of capturing that quiet intensity. But, you know, again, it kind of gets lost in the action. At a certain point, it becomes an action movie. So, Mike, it reminds me of that scene when Chekhov and Captain Terrell from the Reliant first encounter Khan down on the planet. And Khan starts unmasking himself. He starts by taking off his mask really slowly, and he starts pulling off his gloves. It's all really slow and drawn out. And all of that just builds the intensity of this character. You know, he's someone to be reckoned with, even though nothing is happening. And, you know, some of my favorite Star Trek happens when the action is minimal, when there's good dialogue or just these quiet, intense moments or, you know, thoughtful moments or moments that make you focus on who a character really is when there's no action going on. And I just kind of miss that action-free intensity of Khan that we saw in Star Trek II. But I agree that in general, the Khan we see in Star Trek Into Darkness is intense in different ways. And there are lots of places when Khan could have been more vocal, could have been yelling, but he really does kind of understate it. I'm thinking of that scene in the when he's in the brig and Captain Kirk is talking with him through the force field. And you know, that's a really quiet, understated scene that is reminiscent to me of the Khan we saw in Star Trek II. But it's a fleeting moment in the overall picture of Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Zachary, I'll go ahead and give just a brief synopsis of Star Trek Into Darkness. And just in case one of our listeners out there is unfamiliar with this movie, This movie actually begins with a scene on an alien planet. It's a class M planet. Kirk and company are trying to save this planet, and in so doing, they break the Prime Directive. And he gets a dressing down from Captain Pike when they get back to Earth, and actually loses his command of the Enterprise. And so all of Starfleet Command has been pulled together because of a series of terrorist attacks that are taking place on Earth. And they are commissioned to deal with it. And so in the midst of figuring out what exactly is going on and trying to get to the bottom of these terrorist attacks, the terrorist, who turns out to be someone affiliated with Starfleet by the name of John Harriman, actually attacks this meeting of Starfleet's highest commanders, and thus kills Captain Christopher Pike. So James Kirk is in command of the Enterprise again, and they go on a mission to find John Harriman, who, spoiler, turns out to be none other than Khan Noonien Singh. In their pursuit of Khan, Captain Kirk and company discover that it's not just Khan they're after, but actually a shadow organization within Starfleet, led by Admiral Marcus, father of Carol Marcus, who has, under false pretenses, gained a role on the Enterprise. And this shadow organization is seeking an opportunity to wage a preemptive war, a preemptive strike against the Klingons, because they perceive the Klingons as a threat to the Quadrant.
Like I said at the beginning of the show, Mike, it seems clear that the main philosophical issue or ethical issue in Star Trek Into Darkness is the issue of preemptive war. And, you know, it's funny. I remember when this movie first came out, you know, there was a build up to it, and there was these questions, is it Khan or is it not Khan? And it was a very exciting movie. But once I saw the movie and I realized that other than this parallelism with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, that the main issue was how far should Starfleet be willing to go to protect itself? You know, what ethical values can be sacrificed for the sake of safety, for the sake of saving lives, from not having a war? You know, should we launch a preemptive strike against the Klingons? These kinds of issues. You know, I immediately was thinking back to a real time in my own life. When September 11th happened, I was actually a grad student at Syracuse University in New York. I wasn't in New York City when September 11th happened. I was just upstate. I did a year of grad school there before I moved on and did grad school at UC Santa Cruz. But I remember the morning of September 11th, classes were generally canceled. Once it was clear what was happening that morning, classes were canceled. I was supposed to be TAing for an ethics class. I hadn't yet, of course, taught my own courses at that point. I was just a TA. But rather than just canceling class and sending everyone home, the instructor, whose name was Lawrence Thomas, everyone called him LT for short. So hi, LT, if you're listening to this. There were a few students who stuck around. A lot of people went home, and there were people really concerned. People were worried about their parents who worked in the city. It was really an atmosphere of panic up there. The instructor had us, it was a big lecture hall. This class, you know, had probably 400 to 600 students in a very big lecture hall at Syracuse University. And the instructor sat a bunch of students down, whoever was sticking around, the TAs that hadn't gone home yet, me and a couple others. And I remember very vividly, Lawrence Thomas telling us that he said, just wait and see, you know, the dominant issue from here is going to be this question of how far we're willing to go to protect ourselves. What are we willing to give up in order for the sake of safety, for the sake of keeping us secure? And he said, just wait and see. That's going to be the dominant discussion, you know, going forward after this point, you know, make no bones about it. And it was, I remember that very vividly because I had no context for understanding that. I think as an early person in my early 20s without a lot of experience of the world, haven't seen any real major world events other than maybe the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, this was, you know, quite a few years before. This was something I didn't really understand, but I remember the conversation very vividly because he was so passionate about it. And then so when Star Trek Into Darkness comes out and I see the themes of the movie, it just brought me right back to that moment. I said, here it is. You know, how far are we willing to go? You know, should we be willing to start war? Should we be willing to develop new kinds of weapons? Should we be willing to spy on our own citizens? Should we be, you know, the various issues that we see in society today kind of stem back from that moment. You know, we realize that maybe we're not as secure in the world as we like to have thought. When I was growing up in the 80s and into the 90s, we lived in a fairly peaceful time. Yeah, we were at the tail end of the Cold War. We had the Desert Storm in 1991, but that was a relatively small skirmish. And then something like September 11th happens. And, you know, the theme of the entire country changed. It became a question of what are we willing to do to protect ourselves? That led to things like the war in Iraq in 2004. That led to all these issues about privacy that we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. I hate to be too tied to immediately what's happening in the times here. But, you know, the issues about whether the federal government should have access to the information on your iPhone. Should Apple give them a backdoor into your iPhone? These kinds of issues are issues that they just weren't on the radar 20 years ago. And these are issues that are all kind of wrapped up in what I see in Star Trek Into Darkness. You know, if the goal is to keep us safe and secure, mm-hmm. what are we willing to give up, either in terms of our own privacy or in terms of our own values for that sake? And again, I think that's a really fascinating and relevant theme in Star Trek Into Darkness. And I worry it just gets a little glossed over because of the weaknesses of that movie.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that, you know, the movie... because it does raise some interesting questions, and I think it's very sad that it got rather cheesy in the midst of it. And I don't think it was so much Khan, because actually that in itself I think plays into the overall theme that I think the movie has, because after all, you know, Khan was a remnant, a leftover of a period of Earth's history in which we actually resorted to taking human beings and creating weapons out of them. So I think Khan represents something very interesting there. There's actually something that a lot of people would probably find insignificant that I kind of latched onto when I saw this movie. And I go back to my own memories of September 11th. I had literally, Zachary, just found out not even a month before that I was going to be a dad for the first time. I was working in the newspaper business. I was an advertising and marketing manager, and we were actually in a staff meeting when I got a call from my wife on my cell that there had been a plane crash into one of the Twin Towers. And so I went back in the staff meeting and announced it. And of course, you know, we went right to the newsroom and we were watching the live feeds, and I was watching the AP feed as the story was unfolding. And I remember those days of very, very vividly. And I remember thinking, you know, at that time that, you know, in the days that followed, we were identifying who these terrorists were, and we were asking questions like, how did we not catch this, beforehand? And they were laying that groundwork, as you said, how far are we willing to go? But I said at that time that the day is coming when nothing that we will be able to do will possibly allow us to identify terrorists in our midst. And so this movie, beyond the prologue with the Nibiru planet, starts with a terrorist act that is actually committed by a Starfleet officer. Mickey, for Pete's sake, from Doctor Who. For all of our Doctor Who fans out there, our Whovians, it was Mickey. They got poor Mickey to blow up a European Starfleet library. Thomas Harewood, I believe, was the officer's name, who was in London. His family is suffering tremendously. His daughter's incredibly sick, and she's clearly dying of an illness that medicine in 2259, I think it is unable to cure. But John Harriman comes along and offers a potential cure in exchange for Harewood's participation in this bombing. And so that's how this whole movie sort of opens up with this terrorist attack by you know, a Starfleet officer that no one in their wildest imaginations would have suspected. So right from the get-go for me, Zachary, this movie raised some very interesting questions in terms of, you know, war, terrorism, preemptive planning for war. How far are we willing to go? How are we going to identify potential terrorism going forward? It raised some very interesting questions that I think are worth discussing.
You know, it seems clear to me that the dominant ethical theme is one of consequentialism. You know, how far are we willing to go to keep ourselves secure? You know, we want to prevent harm to ourselves or to a greater number of people by causing harm to a smaller number of people. That's what a preemptive war is, right? Mm-hmm. It's for the sake of preventing a worse war, preventing worse consequences. And that seems pretty clear. And I think you can run through the usual philosophical you know, tap dances of that kind of reasoning, right? You can say, well, how many people are we talking about? Are we talking, you know, how many lives can we save if we start a preemptive war versus how many lives would we lose if we let a war with the Klingons happen? You know, we have the issues of short-term versus long-term consequences. You know, what are the consequences a year from now or 10 years from now? Or what would the issue, the consequences be for, you know, the next generation version of, what would the consequences be for a alternate timeline version of the next generation, you know, 75 years down the road, right? So short versus long-term consequences. So that seems pretty clear. And I think, you know, the main issue with consequentialism is that you can end up, you know, committing mm-hmm. acts that strike me as very sort of morally or ethically questionable for the sake of achieving these good consequences. You can end up killing other people. You can end up sacrificing your values. You can end up, you know, committing horrendous acts all in the name of something good. And there are a great many mm-hmm. evils in the world have been committed under the pretense of trying to cause some good outcome. It's the old adage, the ends don't justify the means, right? But, you know, this movie kind of takes the perspective that the ends might justify the means, that if we launch a preemptive war against the Klingons, we can save more the lives of more Federation citizens. So that is just straight up consequentialist ethics. But what's interesting about the way this movie starts out with a Starfleet officer committing the sort of initial act of terrorism that drives the opening of this movie is it really takes the ethical intuitions another direction, right? You know, if you didn't have that issue where, you know, the Starfleet officer commits this act of terrorism for the sake of trying to save his daughter, you know, it would be a straight up consequentialist story. Do we start a war with the Klingons? Do we not start a war with the Klingons? But this very sort of human moment of this Starfleet officer committing this act of terrorism for the sake of saving his daughter, it's a really sympathetic moment where, you know, this guy's in a hard spot. You know, what matters more to him? You know, the lives that he's about to take in committing this act of terrorism or the life of his own daughter. And this reminds me of virtue ethics in which, you know, it's not just a matter of like a numbers game of counting up how many lives you can save versus how many lives are going to be lost. This sort of utilitarianist, consequentialist, you know, calculation, the kind of thing we talked about when we were talking about consequentialism. A few episodes ago on Metatrex, we were talking about consequentialist ethics versus deontological ethics in Deep Space Nine. It strikes me that this officer who commits the act of terrorism is a very sort of sympathetic character. You know, part of me thinks it's right for him to place the life of his own daughter above the lives of anyone else. I mean, it does make it right to, you know, commit the act of terrorism, but it does strike me that his motivation isn't a bad motivation. He's in a serious, you can sympathize with him. He's in a serious rock and a hard place. He cares more about his daughter than anyone on the planet, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to keep his daughter safe. So he's not an evil person.
You can sympathize with him.
And I think it's interesting that our intuitions, you know, kind of, my intuitions at least veer a bit towards virtue ethics. Like, you know, he's a virtuous person, even despite the horrendous acts that he's about to commit, because he's prioritizing his daughter so much. You know, what's your take on this, Mike? I mean, this is just straight up, you know, how far do you go to protect someone you care about? What's the role of this interpersonal relationship? You know, this guy's role as a parent and his relationship with his daughter and what he's willing to do to protect his daughter. I mean, you're a parent and I'm not, so you can speak to this more than I can. What is, you know, does this make him more sympathetic or does this make him more tragic? What's your take on this Starfleet officer as a parent as it relates to virtue ethics versus the consequences of what he's about to do?
Yeah, sympathetic, absolutely. I can relate to this guy because I think I speak for most anyone out there who is a parent. You will go to the ends of the earth if necessary to safeguard, protect the lives of your children, and there's just virtually nothing, you know, I wouldn't do to help my daughter. And I can't imagine, you know, if I'm Mickey from Doctor Who, I can't imagine, you know, being placed in that situation. I'd like.
So we should all look out if we see you wearing a new ring.
Yeah, if I'm
right.
But I say that to say this. I'd like to say, you know, that at the end of the day, I would place. You know, Spock famously said that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, and I would like to think at the end of the day that's where I would fall in this. But I think it also, and I don't mean to veer away from that particular character and his plight, but I think too where this movie really resonates with me is the fact that Khan, to some degree, becomes a sympathetic character because his motivation, although they do a great job kind of sticking to the original mold of Khan, he's very opportunistic, he's very aggressive. But what I think they do so well with his character is, you know, he's been a pawn in a plot, if you will, by Admiral Marcus and this shadow organization, Section 31, if you will, within Starfleet to wage a preemptive strike against the Klingons. And, you know, to some degree, he's almost heroic in the fact that he's trying to bring this to light, but he's also very opportunistic because he's got an axe to grind. But still, you find yourself saying, you know, scratching your head and saying to yourself, you know, is this guy so bad? And I think that's really one of the things they did very well in this movie, because you have a lot of characters inside this story, even Admiral Marcus to some degree, you can relate to. And those are always the juiciest villains are the ones that we can relate to. And I think they do it brilliantly.
That's something Star Trek always does really well. It always humanizes its villains. You very seldom in Star Trek see just an outright evil villain that isn't somewhat sympathetic, where you can't understand his motivations, just a pure power-hungry individual. There's almost always some sort of backstory that makes that character more sympathetic. And it's funny you mentioned Khan as a sympathetic character, because I don't think the actor plays him that sympathetically. But you do see this thread where, you know, he's a lot of the motivation for what he's doing inside Star Trek Into Darkness is because of his concern for his followers, right? Mm-hmm. He cares for his followers, just like the Starfleet officer at the beginning of the movie cares for his daughter.
Yeah.
And that complicates the matter. If it were just a straight up consequentialist calculation, right? We should start a war to save lives, we should do this, you know, commit this act of terrorism to achieve some greater end. You know, that is not a terribly sympathetic situation. It's just a numbers game. And then you just do the calculation. Okay, how many lives can we save versus how many lives can we lose? It reminds me of these examples that you get inside of ethics. I'm thinking of an example known as the trolley problem. Are you familiar with the trolley problem, Mike?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you can tell it's a very 20th century example, right? Mm-hmm. Calling it a trolley, right?
Yes. So
the trolley problem is basically this. Imagine you're you know, standing at a switch, you know, with some train tracks in front of you, trolley tracks, and there's this trolley. And this, you can either throw the switch right or throw the switch left. You can only choose one or the other. If you throw the switch one direction, this trolley with, you know, say 10 or 15 or 20 people is going to fall off a cliff and everyone's going to die on the trolley. If you throw the switch the other direction, there's someone tied to the railroad tracks up ahead and one person is going to get run over by this trolley. So you can save 20 people by sacrificing the one. It's a very sort of self-contained example, mm-hmm, of the kinds of ethical dilemma you see in this movie. You know, can we save lives by, you know, sacrificing a smaller number of people? So that's the basic idea behind the trolley problem. So I'm trying to think of the Star Trek version of this, you know, like the shuttlecraft problem. you know, in this movie, I guess what's interesting about the trolley problem is there's different permutations of it. The basic permutation of it is just, you know, should we throw the switch to, you know, sacrifice the one person to save the 20? But then you can start adding other things into the mix. What if that one person is your mother? What if that one person is your daughter? Mm-hmm. What's someone you deeply care about? Are you justified in sacrificing the 20 to save this one person that you care about for some deeper reason and some sort of virtue ethic sense in the sense of care or interpersonal relationships, things that are, that matter to us as humans besides the purely quantitative aspect of ethics. And so that seems to me what's going on in Star Trek Into Darkness, right? You know, we have the character at the beginning of the movie who's willing to commit this act of terrorism for the sake of saving his daughter. You know, that's, in my mind, somewhat analogous to this example of the trolley problem, being willing to save the one person if it's someone you have a special connection to. You know, I think some people have the intuition that you're justified in saving someone you care about versus saving a bunch of people you don't, that you don't have a relationship with. And that goes counter to our intuition that we should try to save the greatest number of people, kind of in a sort of blind or neutral sense where we don't know who they are. You know, if you don't know who the people are, if it's just one person you don't know versus 20 people you don't know, it seems obvious, save the 20, because none of them matter to you. But if one person matters to you in a special way, then our intuitions often get pulled that other direction. So does that affect the judgment we have of the character at the beginning of the movie, or even the judgment of Khan or Admiral Marcus in their willingness to commit seemingly terrible acts all for the sake of preserving something that they care about. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that's overlooked. I'm glad you mentioned this about Khan, because it would be easy to forget that part of Khan's motivation is to save the people that he cares
about.
Yeah,
he wants
to save
his followers.
A special relationship with his followers. And just like the character at the beginning of the movie has a special relationship with his daughter. It's not just a random person. It's his own daughter. How much does that factor into the ethical judgments we make about the actions?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going back to, the ethical issue, I think it's the old Deanna Troi ordering Geordi to his death to save the Enterprise problem. I really do. I think that scenario is applicable.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that example, Mike, because I actually just watched that episode of Star Trek The Next Generation recently, a few days ago, in fact, and it struck me that what bothers me about it is just kind of the stoicism of it. You know, there's, Counselor Troi has to develop this detachment from the situation, right? As a commander, you know, she's trying to pass her bridge commander's exam so she can become a full commander and be a bridge officer. She has to learn to set aside the concern and the care and the emotional involvement that she has mm-hmm. with people she knows for the sake of saving the 1,000 people on the ship and, in fact, saving the Enterprise itself. She has to be willing to send people to their deaths, even people she cares about. And that's part of being a good commander. So, again, when we're talking about virtue ethics, you have this sense of competing virtues or competing senses of care, right? It's right to care about the 1,000 people on the ship, but at the same time, as a commander, you have to learn to detach yourself from that emotional care for the sake of achieving some better outcome, you know, saving the ship.
Yeah, you're after the best possible set of consequences.
And I love the look on Geordi's face when he's walking off, knowing full well he's walking off to his own death. He's not coming out of it. He's got to save the ship. He walks off, gives a look over his shoulder, goodbye. You know, Counselor Troi kind of acknowledges that that's the last time she's going to see him. But the thing that bothers me about it is the whole thing plays so stoically, right? This is a terrible situation. And, you know, if this were a real example, this is, of course, a training scenario on the holodeck. But if this were a real example, there would be grieving after, even if you don't have time to think about it in the moment. You know that the human element will come into play, if not in the moment, then after the fact.
Yeah.
And it's that after the fact care where you know that, you know, when you've lost someone you care about, you grieve. And mm-hmm. if you have to send someone you care about into harm, you worry about them. And what we don't want to do, I think, in ethics is strip away that care. And, you know, the straight up consequentialist approach, you know, let's sacrifice a bunch of people, send the soldiers in and start a preemptive war for the sake of saving more lives. You know, that is really a cold-hearted way of stripping out all of this, the human element, the emotions and the care and the relationships we have with other people. And I guess the fundamental question is that what we want out of ethics, right? Is it just a numbers game like that, or should we prioritize, these special relationships, this emotional connection we have with people we care about?
Now, for me personally, Zachary, I think the answer is something in between. I think it's a balance between, you know, virtue ethics and something that's more like consequentialism. I think the rule for most of us is to strike a balance between the two. And I think that, you know, when you're dealing with military situations, when you're dealing with a situation in which lives are at stake, perhaps you're a police officer or a fireman, you know, I think to a great degree you have to lean towards consequentialism. But, you know, in many other of our day-to-day circumstances, I think most of us probably lean toward virtue ethics. But again, I think ideally it's striking a balance between the two.
I think what I love about those trolley problem examples, or what we're calling the shuttlecraft problem examples here,
I like
in Star
the shuttlecraft
Trek,
problem.
You know, do you take the shuttlecraft left, or do you take the shuttlecraft right? Which way do you throw the switch, or which button do you push?
The Delta Flyer problem.
The Delta Flyer problem. I like it. I think the thing I like about those examples is that not choosing is not an option, you know, and maybe this works better for a trolley than for a shuttlecraft.
Well, to not choose is to choose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there's only two ways the trolley can go, left or right, there's only two buttons to push, left or right, for the Delta Flyer. Which levers to pull on the old fashioned control panel on the Delta Flyer, right? If there's only two ways the lever can go, left or right. You know, not choosing is a choice, right? It's got to be one or the other. And I love those examples because they force you to choose. You can't just sort of stand back and say, I'm going to play neutral and not get involved in the situation. You're there. You have the power to flip the switch. If you don't flip it one way or the other, you know, it's going to go left or it's going to go right. Essentially, the idea is that not choosing is the same as making a choice, you know, for one way or the other. But I love those examples because they force you to choose. You know, they just... I think in a lot of scenarios in ordinary life, you can get away with being neutral, right? You know, I'm going to choose not to get involved in that situation. I'm going to choose not to intervene when I see some injustice. I'm going to, you know, as a country, we can say, you know, we're going to be isolationist here, and we're not going to get involved in other countries' affairs and whatnot. But, you know, questions like the trolley problem or the shuttlecraft problem force you to make a choice. You know, they just say, look, not choosing is the same as making a choice. To bring this back to consequentialism, I think that the heart of consequentialism is that you're forced to make choices like this. Mm-hmm. You know, consequentialism, I think you're right, when you're a fireman or you're a police officer or you're a military commander or you're a starship captain or an admiral like Admiral Marcus, you're forced to make these hard choices. And the only way to do that is to think more like a consequentialist.
Yes.
You know, you can't get too attached to the people you're trying to save if you're a fireman. You can't get too attached to the people under your command if you're a starship captain. This is the reason that Captain Picard always keeps his distance, right? You know, we talked about this a little, mm-hmm. little while ago on Metatrex when we were talking about poker in Star Trek. You know, there's something symbolic about Captain Picard finally joining the poker game at the end of Star Trek The Next Generation. But, you know, in his own mind, he can't be a good commander unless he's a little bit distant from the people under his command. So he can make those hard choices when he has to order people to their deaths or send them into a situation that is dangerous. You know, that can't be a reason not to make the hard choices. And consequentialism is the best guide you have when you're forced to make those really, really hard choices about, you know, do you take the ship right or take the ship left? You know, you can't just throw the brakes on and drop out of warp and not engage, right? Well, Mike, we talked a little bit about consequentialism. We talked about virtue ethics. The last sort of category of ethical theories I thought we could discuss a little bit as it relates to what we're seeing in Star Trek Into Darkness is deontological ethics, which is, if you recall, a rule-based ethics. You know, that the idea that there are just things that are outright wrong. There are things you just don't do. There are rules you don't violate, or rules that you should follow, or things you should do. Where it doesn't matter what the consequences are, it doesn't matter what the situation is, certain actions are inherently right or inherently wrong, always right or always wrong, regardless of who involved, how many people, what the consequences are. And I think, you know, this is just kind of the diametrically opposed theory to consequentialism. If, you know, if on the one hand you can think, well, okay, let's start a preemptive war with the Klingons. We can save lives that way. On the other hand, that forces you to actively intervene in killing other people or in treating other people as means to achieve some greater end. These are things that seem to violate this sort of fundamental deontological Kantian rule-based ethics, right? Don't kill, don't use other people as a means to your own ends. The things we saw when we were talking about Kant a few episodes ago on Metatrex, you know, Kant had this idea that you don't use other people as means to your own ends. You treat them as ends to themselves, treat them as with respect, as autonomous beings just like you, and not use them as a means. But whenever you make these hard consequentialist choices, you're forced into doing that. You end up using certain people in a situation as tools to achieve a greater good rather than treating them as people with rights or with respect or whatnot. And I just think that this is the fundamental problem here. If you choose that consequentialist path, if you start that preemptive war with the Klingons, you end up using people as tools and not treating them as people who have rights, and you end up violating that principle. Now, again, that's the $64,000 question, right? Which of those theories is the right way to think about these complex ethical dilemmas? But at very least, you have to be aware of the trade-offs. If you choose this consequentialist path, like Admiral Marcus is doing in Star Trek Into Darkness, then, of course, you end up committing some acts that are more morally questionable from a Kantian or a rule-based standpoint. He ends up killing people. He ends up starting wars. Sure. He ends up not treating people with respect. And you just go down the list, and all these things happen as a result of his maybe well-intentioned, maybe not well-intentioned quest to save more lives by starting this preemptive war.
Yeah, I agree. And let's take a moment to talk a little bit about the Klingons. I think apart from Worf and B'Elanna, we see the Klingons in the whole of Star Trek about 123 or 4 times, I believe.
Oh, is that all?
Yes, is that all? It seems like they're always there, right? That's one of the things that this movie really, really comes short on is a valid explanation for why we were even toying with the idea of a preemptive war against the Klingons. You're going on, JJ, hello, you're going on assumptions here that these Klingons are to some degree, the same kind of Klingons that we have in the Prime Universe. And, you know, we know from, for instance, I believe the episode of TNG is First Contact, that Captain Picard says that our first contact with Klingons was less than stellar, and it led to years of conflict. We see the Klingons in the original series as being a nemesis, let's face it, they were more of a thorn in the side. They were an antagonist. We did have a very brief, I believe, 4-day war with the Klingons until the Organians intervened and put a stop to it. And then after that, we're just we're just having little skirmishes with them here or there, or barroom fights on deep space stations. The Klingons are a warrior class of people. They obviously operate under a different set of virtue ethics. You mentioned deontological ethics. I don't know. We kind of talked about this a little bit in Metatrex when I believe the title of the show was Klingon Emily Post. Talked a little bit about Klingon virtue ethics, and I don't think we drew any conclusions as to whether or not they have any type of rules-based ethics, although Worf, at least to some degree, always has one of these Klingon rules, such as Klingons do not beg. Do not start preemptive wars.
I think they actually. But
I believe they do as well. But, you know, here we are, you know, here's Starfleet considering starting a preemptive war with the Klingons, which, you know, I have to, it begs the question, Zachary, you know, what the heck is Admiral Marcus thinking? Because, you know, somewhere on Kronos, the number one song in, 2255 is War. Huh. What is it good for? Absolutely everything. Say it again. You know what I mean? they love it. They live for it. War is what this is what the species lives for. And why in the world, you know, would we provoke the Klingons? I don't know, but Admiral Marcus seems to think that this is a step in the right direction towards balancing the powers in the quadrant.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you thought to mention the way that the Klingons are portrayed inside Star Trek Into Darkness, because I think the way they're portrayed betrays some of the psychological motivation that you see inside the movie. You know, in Star Trek, the original series, the Klingons, while they're a little scary, they're largely comical. They're theatrical. They're a known quantity. There's not really much of a mystery to the Klingons, right? They're antagonists, but we know who they are. We know what we're dealing with. They're not really scary per se, I think, right? And in Star Trek Into Darkness, it strikes me they're portrayed very in a very sort of scary way. You know, they're masked. It's dark. We don't know much about them. And it just strikes me that there's this underlying fear of the Klingons that is driving Admiral Marcus. And I think this is true of a lot of people. I mean, fear is one of the main motivators for a lot of human action. It causes a lot of the evils we see in the world, and it can explain a lot of the behavior we see from individuals and whatnot.
Sure.
And it's very easy when there's something that's unknown, it's very easy to be afraid of it. And I think portraying the Klingons in this sort of dark, masked, unknown, slightly scary kind of light explains it helps bolster this latent fear of war with the Klingons, right? For all Admiral Marcus knows, the Klingons are planning an invasion, an invasion of their own. They're planning to start a war with us. Clearly, no one's taken the time to get to know the Klingons as a people or as a culture. The kind of deep cultural dive you see in Star Trek: The Next Generation, right? And this is why it's fascinating, because you know the Klingons, even though they weren't terribly scary in the original series, they were still bad guys and they were still a force to be reckoned with. And in Star Trek: The Next Generation, you see kind of an unmasked look at Klingon culture. It humanizes the Klingons, or not in the sense of what you see in Star Trek VI, you know, the Homo sapiens only club. But, you know, it makes the Klingons sympathetic and beings that we can relate to, as opposed to a mystery or people that we don't know, we don't trust, we don't know what their motivations are. And by portraying Klingons not in that, 1980s, 1990s Star Trek: The Next Generation way, by portraying them very much in line with what the original series was trying to do, make them bad guys, but unknown, scary bad guys that for all we know are trying to start a war with us. When you're in that situation, you don't know if someone is out to get you. You have this latent fear that can cause, you know, the kinds of reasoning that Admiral Marcus has. I just think that fear is the underlying motivator in that kind of situation. And Star Trek Into Darkness seems to play that up in the actual way that the Klingons are portrayed as characters.
Yeah, what you're describing to me, Zachary, sounds a little bit like Star Trek Bay of Pigs. It's like Bay of Targ.
Yeah, but I think that's it exactly, right? You know, think of the escalation that happens in that kind of situation.
Yes.
All as a result of the fear of the unknown.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I do. I agree with you 100%. I think that is largely Admiral Marcus's position. It's something that is less based on intelligence and more based on fear. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen how that sort of scenario has played out in the real world, and it certainly plays out here in Star Trek Into Darkness. And I think to some degree in the Prime Universe, that sort of mentality really was at work on both sides. But I don't know. I mean, again, we didn't really see that fleshed out very well. Although, once again, I have to give the JJ-verse props for creating a Klingon that is just absolutely intimidating. There's nothing comical. There's nothing theatrical about them. They're just absolutely intimidating.
And I think with a lot of these consequentialist examples, like the trolley problem or the shuttlecraft problem, you know, the stakes are still kind of low. You know, in the worst case scenario, in the trolley problem, in the worst case scenario, 20 people die, right? You know, it's a bad consequence, but it's not a world-ending consequence. But if you take the Klingon seriously as foes, if they have a fleet of their own and they've got weapons of mass destruction of their own, and they have the ability to conquer the entire Federation, presumably, right? If the Klingons and if we end up in a war with the Klingons and
sure.
Klingons end up winning, that could mean the end of life in the Federation or in Starfleet, life as we know it in the 23rd century. And that kind of, you know, world-ending perspective, it's almost apocalyptic, right? Here comes the coming apocalypse, the war with the Klingons, that could be the end of our civilization. It's not like you can say, you know, let's wait and see how it plays out. Let's wait and get to know the Klingons a little bit. Maybe the Klingons aren't that bad. I think the idea there is that while you're taking it slowly and trying to, you know, gauge the situation and feel it out and be cautious and tentative, for all you know, the Klingons are planning your world-ending, apocalyptic, you know, world war, universe war, galactic war kind of scenario, right? And I think that ups the ante. You just can't, you know, I think from our relatively peaceful times, you know, yeah, it's been fairly chaotic, but, you know, we don't have a world war going on. We've got some isolated acts of terrorism in this world. We've had a war in Iraq that's now over. Okay, things have calmed down a little bit, but we don't have a sort of civilization ending threat right now. Nothing like we saw in maybe World War II. And I think it was realistic to say, you know, this could be the end of the United States as we know it, right? I don't think we have that kind of perspective in the world right now. But if you posit that that's the situation, if the Klingons, the Klingon scenario, the Klingon situation in Star Trek Into Darkness is apocalyptic in the sense of civilization, potentially civilization ending, then you know, it seems less reasonable to say, well, maybe we should wait it out and see if the Klingons are really nice guys after all.
Yeah. I think we're dealing with militarism here when, you know, quite frankly, there wasn't even a mention of any type of diplomatic envoy or diplomatic solution. I mean, you're waiting for somebody to say, you know.
You mean Uhura speaking Klingon wasn't diplomacy enough for you?
No, I mean.
I love her speaking Klingon, by the way. She owns that Klingon.
Oh, she totally owns the Klingon.
That's one of my favorite scenes. You know, there are some scenes that I love in Star Trek Into Darkness. That is one of my favorite Uhura really dominating the conversation with the Klingons.
Oh, when she tells Kirk, "You brought me here to talk Klingon. Let me talk Klingon."
Sit down.
That's the Uhura I wanted Klingon in the original series as well. But, you know, I mean, nobody mentioned, you know, sitting down with a slice of Rokeg blood pie and, you know, some fire wine and you know.
Well, they didn't have replicators yet, so Rokeg blood pie was not on the table. Right? No one had the recipe, you know. So they left the Klingon cookbook at home.
No, let's just fire a bunch of torpedoes with human beings.
I think that's our show title right there, Metatrex 20 Klingon Cookbook.
Klingon Cookbook. I'm leaning toward Bay of Targ. But, instead we're going to fire torpedoes with human beings at them and start a war. And isn't that like real life?
Well, I guess the question is, of course, I keep wanting to ask these tough questions because, you know, there are, if this were a real scenario and we were really in Starfleet and there was a potential war with the Klingons, you wouldn't have the luxury of talking about this in the abstract. Is the fact that the Klingon scenario is potentially civilization ending, does that give license for the characters, namely Admiral Marcus, to ignore door number three, to ignore the diplomatic approach, to skip baking a Rokeg blood pie and having a Golden Girls, type cheesecake fest with the Klingons? Does this give him a pass on that? Is it okay for him to not think of that as an option for the sake of dealing head on with this potentially civilization ending scenario? Does the unknown and the potential consequences, which are disastrous? I mean, it's one thing if the consequences aren't actually disastrous, right? If the consequences of a war with the Klingons are being blown out of proportion, if the Klingons don't really have those weapons of mass destruction, if the Klingons aren't really planning to start a war, but if the Klingons are really aggressive and there's a potential war and it could be civilization ending, is it okay for him to think about preemptive war as the primary strategy?
I'd love to answer your question, but I can't get the visual image out of my mind of B. Arthur and Betty White in Starfleet miniskirts and go-go boots.
I can totally picture the Golden Girls as Klingons. Try to get that out of your head, listeners.
Lursan Bator. You know, right. Betty White is still very active, you know.
Oh,
maybe.
Yeah, she was actually Lursa, didn't you know? Yeah, just kidding.
Nice. Well, Zachary, we're rolling up on about an hour here. This has been a great conversation. Any final thoughts before we close out the show today?
You know, I really don't have much in the way of final thoughts. I mean, I love that Star Trek Into Darkness raises these kinds of issues. I think Star Trek Into Darkness really gets a bad rap because it really does make a bona fide attempt to deal with a contemporarily relevant situation. You know, in the last 15 years in the real world, we've had issues of safety and security and privacy and wars. And these are issues that are they're important real world issues, and Star Trek Into Darkness tackles those issues head on. And Star Trek has always done that. If there's any sort of, you know, contemporary situation in the 1960s, you had the Cold War played out between the Federation and the Klingons. And now we see the sort of current geopolitical state, you know, played out between, between the Federation and the Klingons. So it's really everything that you'd expect from Star Trek. That's what I love about this. It is the same races, the humans and the Klingons, but not in the 1960s Cold War setting, in a post September 11th world where we have wars with Iraq and we've got issues of privacy and security. And these are issues that matter to us now, and they're different issues than what we got in the 60s. And again, I just think it's a little unfortunate that the weaknesses of Star Trek Into Darkness overshadow some of that really good ethical material. So I guess, Mike, I really want to end with a challenge to our listeners. Anyone who says to themselves that Star Trek Into Darkness is not their favorite Star Trek movie, maybe even their least favorite Star Trek movie, and I'm one of these people, I would rather watch almost any other Star Trek movie than Star Trek Into Darkness. I think the weaknesses of Star Trek Into Darkness for me are that bad, where I would rather watch any other movie. That said, though, try to watch Star Trek Into Darkness bracketing all of that. Set aside everything you don't like about it and focus on these ethical dilemmas. And think about our own world and the situation we're in as a country, as a nation, with certain kinds of values and certain kinds of you know, rights and certain kinds of an expectation of certain kinds of quality of life. And what are we willing to give up for the sake of keeping ourselves safe and secure and continuing to sustain the kind of world that we want to live in? If you look at Star Trek Into Darkness from that standpoint, I think you'll find that it's a much more interesting, deeper movie than you might think, mm-hmm. given the ridiculousness of some of the stuff that unfolds with Khan and Admiral Marcus inside this movie, and the way it sort of tries to parallel Star Trek II. It just that just falls flat for me. It doesn't work. I don't find it terribly interesting. But if you bracket all of that and focus on it as an ethical dilemma movie and a politically relevant movie, given the state of the world today, I think you'll find it's a much more interesting movie. So again, just, you know, give it a rewatch. Don't hate it prematurely. Try to look at it from that perspective, from the ethical, political, geopolitical, and social perspective, this ethical dilemma perspective. How far are we willing to go for the sake of saving our society or people you care about? And think of it like a hyped up, amped up, Klingon-sized version of the trolley problem, and see whether it's a better movie. And for me, it makes it a better movie. It's still probably my least favorite, but it's not a bad movie. It actually puts it in the category of, it's a really good Star Trek movie in the sense of holding true to the metaphorical aspect of Star Trek. You know, that Star Trek is a metaphor for the important issues we face in the world. Star Trek has always done that, and Star Trek Into Darkness, whether it did it really well or not, it is open for debate, but I think it at least does it. It's not a shallow movie. It's a relevant movie if you look at it from that standpoint. So if you're listening out here and you don't like Star Trek Into Darkness, give it another rewatch from that standpoint, and let us know your thoughts.
Yeah, or dare I say, watch it for the first time, because Zachary, as it goes, I know there are a lot of folks out there who, you know, the JJ movies suck, and yet they've never really taken the time to objectively watch them, and I would just challenge our listeners to check this one out again, or watch it for the first time. And you're absolutely right, and I don't want to echo what you've already said, because you've said it very well, and you very much sum up my own thoughts. And the only thing that I would add to it is to say that this is actually a very deep movie with some very interesting moral and ethical problems that they're dealing with. Just unfortunately, there's just so much cheese and especially towards the end of the movie, that I don't think they did it well. But I will echo what you said once again and say that the movie has some very interesting situations. It deals with some moral and ethical dilemmas, I think, in some very interesting ways that are very relevant to the world that we live in. Interestingly enough, I think that by going back and revisiting it and setting aside, you know, some of the cheesiness of, you know, Zachary Quinto's Spock screaming Khan and, you know, the parallels to, you know, to the original Wrath of Khan, I think if you set those things aside and just appreciate the story, and I think what you're going to walk away with is an appreciation for really what Star Trek to some degree is all about. And it is just a metaphor for real life, for the world that we live in. Unfortunately, I think we make a lot of assumptions with the JJ movies. I mean, after all, we only have, you know, about 4 hours of movie here. And so, you know, it relies heavily on assumptions. And there are a lot of things going on in the movie that aren't really fleshed out very well, and I think that's just typical of a movie. But you know, they're gonna do it again here in a few months with the third installment of the JJ universe, where we're gonna tackle some very interesting philosophical questions, moral and ethical situations that they're going to be diving into. And honestly, I'm looking forward to it. You know, as I said before, you know, 2009 come out, and you know, I was excited. I went to the theater. It was a bit of a letdown, but you know, I swallowed it, and you know, I go back, and Into Darkness was somewhat of salt in the wound, and it's, you know, it's taken me a while to get over it, but I'm actually looking forward to the movie coming out, and the new movie Beyond, as Chris says, and checking it out, because once again, I'll say it one final time before I wrap up my final thoughts. They do tackle these issues in very interesting ways, and so true to Star Trek, they're not afraid to take these philosophical questions and explore them.
You know, I think one thing that's fun to do with these movies is to play the "what would you do" game. You know, if you were in the shoes of that Starfleet officer at the beginning of Star Trek Into Darkness, what would you do, right? If you had the opportunity to save your daughter who was going to die, if you had to do something terrible, what would you do if you were Admiral Marcus and you were faced with the potential end of life as you know it in the Federation? Because of an impending war with the Klingons, and you have the power to prevent it, what would you do? And I think, you know, it, certainly in the new Star Trek movie, Star Trek Beyond, there will be questions like that. What would you do if you were Captain Kirk in this certain situation? You know, it's easy to forget that these kinds of dilemmas that you see in a movie like Star Trek Into Darkness are metaphors for real situations, right? You know, you can imagine a situation like that, either a contrived example like the shuttlecraft problem, or a higher stakes political situation. You know, potential World War III kind of situation. You know, put yourself in the driver's seat, in the captain's chair, and ask yourself, what would you do if you were one of those characters? You know, it really it forces you to take the situation seriously and adds to the drama of watching the movies. You know, it's if you're just a passive observer watching a movie and it's a little ridiculous, you can say, yeah, okay, I don't like that movie. It's not important to me. But if you force yourself to think, what would you do if you were a real person in that real situation? Now solve the ethical dilemma in front of you. You know, that gives you much more reason to take the movie seriously, and hopefully it makes you engage with it a bit more. I think, you know, there's a way of not engaging with Star Trek Into Darkness, and I was really like that when I first watched the movie, other than recognizing this metaphor for the current state of the world. You know, when you put yourself in the persona of one of the characters, as if you were in the holodeck, right? What if this were a situation on the holodeck and you were one of the players in the movie? Mm-hmm. What would you do now if this were a holo novel? Now it becomes a really interesting ethical conundrum that you have to reason your way out of and figure out how do you save the sinking ship, so to speak. So, you know, I think it's just it's a better movie than it gets credit for. So I hope our listeners out there take the time to give it another rewatch with a different perspective than maybe they've given it a chance to do so far. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about Star Trek Into Darkness today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Tripp sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con!
To the journey! All right, next one is from Damian Haywood. And, Damian, come on. Which Voyager crew member would you hate to be stuck in the Delta Flyer with? He's always so negative. I called him on this the other day. I said, Damian, why always with the negativity? He said, at least I'm consistent. The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor. We start getting hints of Cap. We start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew. And we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Trex.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzell would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzell's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other.
So he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down together.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of Meta Treks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our handle is @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/trekfm. Trek FM. And while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not planning preemptive strikes, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. That's probably where I'm most active. I'm in the Babel Conference always. On Twitter, my handle is at cmichael1701. And I've recently started an Instagram account that is also cmichael1701. And Zachary, where can our listeners find you out there on the interwebs?
Well, you can always find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling, ZachareyFruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.